to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we'll certainly be tying in some of the issues around the military-industrial complex, slightly more broader than the ones we'll touch on in the first part of the show. As you may expect, we're going to be talking about some of the fallout, as it were, from, well, several recent large parades and disruptions that took place within them. But before we can move on, well, in relatively big news today, the attorneys general of the District of Columbia and the state of Maryland filed suit on Monday today, alleging that Donald Trump has violated anti-corruption statutes in the U.S. Constitution. The two regional governments are alleging that given Trump's continued ownership and entanglements with his businesses, that many of the deals and operations undertaken by the Trump Organization essentially amount to taking payments from foreign governments. The question at stake is the so-called emoluments clause that states that public officials won't take, quote, any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state, end quote. An emolument is a payment or a fee or a profit from an investment or an asset. D.C. and Maryland are arguing that Trump has not taken enough steps to separate himself from the business of the Trump Organization to guard against this. They note that despite Trump stating that he was turning business affairs over to his sons, Eric Trump, one of said sons, has previously stated that he would be giving President Trump regular updates on the financial health of the company. The suit also alleges that Trump's ownership of the Trump Hotel is also unconstitutional in and of itself. They noted that the General Services Administration reversed course on its previous ruling that Trump would have to fully divest from the hotel, and that reversal was improper. The business at the hotel is likely to be front and center in the suit, given that, as the Washington Post notes, quote, the Embassy of Kuwait held an event at the hotel, switching its initial booking from the Four Seasons. Saudi Arabia, the destination of Trump's first trip abroad, also booked rooms at the hotel through an intermediary on more than one occasion since Trump's inauguration. Turkey held a state-sponsored event there last month, and in April, the ambassador of Georgia stayed at the hotel and tweeted its compliments. There's also in the Constitution a prohibition on domestic emoluments from the states that seeks to prevent the president from favoring one state over another. The suit alleges that Trump is also violating this because the Trump Organization is pursuing deals in various states, and that could entice those same states to grant subsidies, zoning waivers, and the like to curry favor with the president for something those states want. D.C. and Maryland argue that this gives them particular standing, given that the Trump Hotel in D.C. could take business away from D.C. Convention Center and Maryland Convention Hotels, which put both entities in the position of either endorsing and facilitating the special treatment or potentially being placed at a disadvantage. Now, if a judge allows this case to go forward, the implications could be relatively significant. The attorneys general in D.C. and Maryland are saying their first step in the case will be to demand Donald Trump's tax returns to evaluate the extent of his foreign relationships. This is actually the second lawsuit filed on this issue in January. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed a lawsuit along similar lines. Last Friday, the Trump administration argued that lawsuit should be dismissed because, among other things, no one had objected to George Washington selling plantation produce on the open market. There you go. A group of several Democratic congressional members have also said they were going to file a similar suit sometime soon. Either way, Trump could be in trouble here because of his desire to retain at least some control of his businesses. So perhaps his riches, not Russia, will be the true source of articles of impeachment. Tomorrow is primary day in the state of Virginia. Both Democrats and Republicans will be choosing gubernatorial candidates for what will be one of the most watched political races this year. One major issue is almost certainly going to be a number of pipelines, oil pipelines, gas pipelines set to be built in Virginia that Democrats almost certainly will try to make an issue of in their campaign, and that Republicans will also use to try to gin up votes from the regions where they claim fracking will create jobs. Most notably, there's the 600-mile-long Atlantic Coast Pipeline that would cross right through the heart of Virginia as it travels from West Virginia to North Carolina. The $5.1 billion project would cut through the heart of some pristine wilderness and cause all sorts of other issues. In Buckingham County, Virginia, a heavily black county, not too far from my hometown, actually, it would place a massive toxic compressor station. And this is also a county that faces serious environmental issues from factory farms already. Oh, and they'd also have to blow the tops off of mountains along 38 miles of the route. Then there's the Mountain Valley Pipeline that'll cut through West Virginia and Southwest Virginia. That pipeline will require three of those toxic compressor stations that bring air pollution, groundwater contamination, unsafe noise levels, and lowered property values. It would also disrupt the iconic Appalachian Trail. Now, these two pipelines and two more proposed pipelines have supercharged the anti-pipeline activism in the state. In the Democratic primary, it's been a big issue, one of the few divisive issues. The Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren endorsed candidate Tom Perriello has made an opposition to these pipelines a cornerstone of his campaign. Ralph Northam, who's the establishment candidate who's trying to lean pretty left, though, has been noncommittal but clearly is concerned about opposition among the Democratic base to these pipelines. Republicans, of course, are for it. And the top Republican candidate, Ed Gillespie, will certainly want to make promoting pipelines and fracking a big part of any conversation around job creation in the General Electric. And the natural gas companies are not staying on the sidelines either. They've started a new organization called Your Energy. Pretends to be a grassroots campaign while pushing industry talking points. They have a tiny little disclaimer on their website. For instance, they claim that blocking these pipelines would hurt Virginia's economy, which would, quote, struggle to get back on track, end quote, without them. Which is an interesting choice of words, given that according to Forbes, Virginia is the sixth best state in America to do business and was in the top two on that list every year from 2006 to 2013. CNBC, which takes a slightly dimmer view as Virginia's 13th best state in the nation to do business. So it seems like Virginia's economy is not exactly off track in the first place, unless we're talking about low wages. Your energy, this group, nice little name there, also says that it's all good because they also want to do something about climate change. They're for doing something. They just don't think that you shouldn't have to not frack to do that. However, quote, 80% of fossil fuel reserves need to stay in the ground for us to stay below 2 degrees centigrade of warming, according to 350.org. And as we've told you before on this show, quote, we're only at 1 degree now, and we're already seeing more storms, flooding, heat waves, drought, and island nations at risk of going underwater. 2 degrees is going to mean a lot of human suffering and tremendous damage to the planet. So actually, if you care about climate change, you do need to keep basically all fossil fuels in the ground. Either way, get ready for Virginia to become ground zero in the energy conversation in 2017. And one other issue we've talked about quite a bit on this show is the status of consent decrees under the Trump administration, and that, you know, most of them were not going to be either be followed through or actually they weren't going to create any new ones. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, contrary to all evidence, has insisted that they are a blunt tool that's unnecessary because it really is just a few bad apples ruining police departments. That's a logical fallacy on a couple levels. One, the entire quote is amazing how people forget this. One bad apple spoils the whole bunch, which in and of itself implies a systemic issue, not an issue of individuals. However, on a more fact-based level, literally every report that has ever led to a consent decree has exposed systemic abuses of the constitutional rights of citizens of those particular cities, in particular in the Black and Latino communities. Now, in Chicago, there's been quite a back and forth here since Trump was elected between Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Attorney General Jeff Sessions about whether or not they were going to move forward with a consent decree based on a Justice Department investigation in the Obama era. Now, last week, they reached a compromise, alleged compromise. What they're calling a compromise is that there will be, quote, an independent monitor that will oversee reforms but can't actually require the CPD to allow investigations, dedicate resources to reform, enforce a timeline, or implement any specific reform. So in other words, there's no oversight at all, in fact. So as expected on this show, and I think by just about every thinking person, Jeff Sessions is using his authority to do everything possible to let the cops off the hook. And while we're talking about conflicts of interest here, Donald Trump tried to make a big splash with his, quote, infrastructure week last week, which more or less fell flat once it became clear that Trump had no actual proposals with a plan that seemed to consist primarily of selling off infrastructure to private businesses. Enthusiasm seemed to wane, particularly among Democrats who thought this was an area maybe they could work with Trump. It has, however, excited the people who stand to make the most money off of this mass looting of public resources. According to The Intercept, Transurban, Centra, and TransCore, three major toll operators have retained federal lobbyists to influence the upcoming plan. And Transurban has a bit of a reputation that gives some flavor of what the future could be like under said privatized sources. For instance, Transurban, which operates a bunch of toll roads in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., once jacked those tolls up to $30 in the middle of a snowstorm. Sometimes they have this equipment, the electronic equipment that, you know, when you come through with the Easy Pass, makes mistakes. And it could be months before people actually know that it didn't register that they drove through and that they allegedly owe some money on these tolls. And in the same D.C. suburbs here, Washington Post related how this can play out, telling one story of a woman, Joanne Brown, who was initially assessed $4.15 for missing five tolls on the Capitol Beltway's 495 express lanes, but didn't receive a violation notice until 60 days later. She tried to pay the tolls and a $100 fee, but that was rejected by Transurban. And then ultimately they got in this back and forth and she wound up being assessed $3,000, actually slightly over $3,000 for unpaid tolls, fees, and fines, ultimately. So just get prepared for your highways, your water, your air travel, and your air travel, among other things, to get the same treatment and become the subject of intense profiteering if Trump's so-called infrastructure plan is actually able to be carried out. Although, like we said, there is no real actual plan for what he's going to do anyway. However, it's worth noting that some of the top officials who may be developing this plan have some conflicts of interest of their own here. Elaine Chao, who's the Secretary of Transportation, former board member of Wells Fargo, who in a recent investment note from just after the election noted there could be, quote, investment opportunities in this kind of private sector infrastructure sell-off, going on to note the ways investors could benefit. And by the way, this is before Trump had said he wanted to do a big private sector sell-off. Goldman Sachs, which has all sorts of top alumni in the Trump administration, is actually advising four states already on how to privatize highways and has invested $3 billion in a fund aimed at infrastructure. And in fact, in one recent case, Goldman advised Indiana on privatizing a highway and creating a toll road while they were invested in three of their funds were invested in the company that was going to operate the tolls. So quite a conflict of interest there. So nevertheless, while Trump's whole infrastructure plan is in development, there can be very little doubt what it will ultimately amount to. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are switching gears a little bit here, but we are very happy to be joined in the studio here as we switch topics by Tracy Redd, who's from Black Lives Matter DC and Keep DC for Me. Joe Rainey, who's the founder and CEO of Practice Makes Progress and a member leader of If Not Now. And Mish from The Future is Feminist. Thank you all so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So, Tracy, I will start with you here. There was, as many people, well, people who may or may not know who are not in the Washington, D.C. area, obviously June is Pride Month. This past weekend was the Pride Parade and Festival in Washington, D.C., a very large event in this region. So that's some of the context around what was going on here. Now, and under the, I don't know if the banner, this is the right way to say it, or hashtag or whatever, No Justice, No Pride, there were a number of protest actions that took place. Maybe, Tracy, you could just give us a little capsule view of what people were upset about protesting, and maybe a little bit about what you personally were involved in.
Yeah, a lot of people were protesting Capitol Pride Parade this year because Capitol Pride Alliance does not believe in intersectionality. Over and over again, they have corporate sponsorships like Wells Fargo, which is done for indigenous genocide, and they also supported the pipeline that was going through Standing Rock. And they also had the Metropolitan Police Department from D.C. in the parade. And I guess they forgot that the first Pride was a riot against the police in New York City at Stonewall, led by a trans woman of color. So when you have police that are continuing to kill Black and brown people in a parade that we're trying to be to celebrate our lives and who and what we are, it's kind of disrespectful. And people are like, enough is enough. We're tired of just Capitol Pride Alliance being full of gay white men that come from this elite status, and most of our community looks like Black, brown, poor, disabled, and all this other stuff, but Capitol Pride Alliance doesn't reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mish, you were also there. What brought you out to Capitol Pride and made you want to engage in an action there?
First of all, it's pretty disgusting that corporations such as Lockheed Martin, which is the blockade that I was at, had a float in a pride parade. Lockheed Martin has been in business with countries that in which it is legal to be part of the LGBTQ community, and they sell weapons that kill members of the LGBTQ community. They go as far as selling technology to police that surveil already marginalized communities. So there's no way that I could or our group could support this. It's important to go back to the roots of Pride, that Pride was meant to be in protection of marginalized people, and it's become kind of a party for Capital Pride as a party for privileged people.
Well, Jill, I don't know if you were out there on Saturday and what you saw. I mean, I'm curious your thoughts on this. Certainly, this has been a building issue in several cities over the past couple of years. I know that I think it was last year where Black Lives Matter in the Bay Area, I believe, refused to participate over some police over the issue of the police and their involvement. The extra policing that I think was coming due to the Pulse nightclub shooting and things that had happened. So obviously an issue that is becoming more and more of something. So your thoughts in general on what took place there?
I absolutely am supportive of the No Justice, No Pride actions. I'm a member of, if not now, the American Jewish Youth Movement to end the American Jewish community's support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinians. And in D.C., if not now, was involved in the Disrupt J20 actions on inauguration weekend. And as a result of the relationships we made during those actions, we were invited to be a part of No Justice, No Pride. But because Pride Weekend in D.C. happened to be a couple days after the 50th anniversary of Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, we've been running a 50 years too many campaign the last couple weeks, and unfortunately simply didn't have capacity to also show up as a cohesive movement for No Justice, No Pride, though many members of If Not Now participated in their own capacities. And I know If Not Now members in other cities are working on their own way to show up for our whole community during their city's Pride celebrations. I would have particularly loved to have led an If Not Now contingent of the No Justice, No Pride disruptions, specifically because of the intersection of Israel's occupation and U.S. Militarization of police. There is a series of partnerships and training programs that connects American police officers, ICE officers, FBI agents, other border patrol and other law enforcement officials from the United States with Israeli military and police forces to take the worst lessons of Israel's occupation of the Palestinians and use those tactics against Black and brown people in the United States, including Black, brown, and Muslim LGBTQ people. And If Not Now is building a movement of young American Jews who want to show up for ourselves and each other, including by insisting on equality in the United States and in Israel and Palestine.
Well, and that parade in and of itself was controversial, so I want to swing back to that. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about some of the controversial activities, I guess you could say that, that took place at Capitol Pride in Washington, D.C. this weekend, and some that also took place at a large, well, I don't know, I guess I would say occupation of Palestine celebrating parade in New York there, but perhaps other people would look at it a different way. But obviously this is an issue that has been with us really for some time in a lot of different contexts. So happy to keep talking about it as we have before. Continue to be joined by Tracy Redd, who's from Black Lives Matter DC and Keep DC for Me, Jill Rainey, who's the founder and CEO of Practice Makes Progress and a member leader of If Not Now, and Mish from The Future is Feminist. Now, I'll just stick with my same order here. Tracy, I'll start with you. You know, I guess, so the criticism of the events, and I should say quickly here, the concept of what you all were doing was trying to blockade these floats, basically, so people can get an idea in their mind of these various entities. that we were talking about the last time in the last segment. So moving forward. So the criticism that some people have of the action is that, well, you know, this is a big event where many people come. Well, there's many criticisms. Okay, I'm just going to throw this one out there. That people come from all around the region. A lot of places, you know, it's very dangerous to be an LGBTQ person, and that they don't really know about some of the internal dynamics of what's going on with Capitol Pride. They just want to celebrate themselves around other people like themselves, and that it is unfair, I guess, to that sentiment as well, to stop or delay the parade. So that's one of the things I heard. I'm curious your response to that.
My first response is that no one died. The only people that I saw arrested were those that were aggressive towards the protesters. And no one got hurt except for a couple of us did get hit with thrown objects from balconies from apartments. But people have to realize that we exist at intersections. I can be black and gay at the same time. I can be black, gay, and a woman, and a Muslim, and an undocumented immigrant at the same time. So, yes, all of these issues play into each other. And if you're upset, then you might want to ask yourself why you're upset and try to understand why we're out here in the first place. Because Pride is not a celebration of Lockheed Smith. I mean,
Lockheed Martin.
I'm with you. Martin. I don't know these people. I don't care about them. Or MPD or Wells Fargo or all these, or the Marriott Hotel or the Hilton Hotel. That's not what Pride should be. So if you're upset that we're stopping your Pride, quote unquote, celebration, then maybe you don't know what celebration is and what Pride, what the history of Pride is. Mm-hmm. Because we take it back to its roots. And so we actually pay homage to Marsha P. Johnson and the other trans people and sex workers that we're going against. That rioted at Stonewall, we were paying them tribute in my mind. And mm-hmm. so if you were really celebrating, you would have joined us.
Mm. Well, Mitch, I'm curious your thoughts on the same question. I don't want to editorialize too much here because I'm curious what you all think. But I guess one of the other things I heard in the course of this from people was, well, if you are, I'm just going to pick a random Citibank or something. I don't even know if they were in there. They're always in there in New York. Wells Fargo, that's another bank. I don't know what I'm thinking. That people who work there, that their participation is because it's being encouraged at their job for them to be out, which wasn't always the case. And that to some degree, it represents progress that now all these companies are out there saying that, like, yes, we have inclusive policies and so on and so forth. And that was also an issue that people felt, you know, it's sort of putting the onus on these individuals who are just trying to celebrate, you know, the fact that they can be out at work as opposed to the company, which was the stated goal of the protest. So I think some criticism of whether or not the stated target was the actual target. Curious your thoughts there. And then I know, Joe, you also want to get in on that one.
I think the main problem is not the people who are working for these corporations, although they are evil. It's not the people that are the problem. It's that these evil corporations are using something that is important to us, the LGBT community, something that is supposed to celebrate. They're using us as an advertisement. And while it may seem like they're just supporting us, people need to stop giving these big corporations that kill people the benefit of the doubt. They don't care. It's just an advertisement for them, and that's unacceptable.
Mm. Joel Rennie.
And additionally, many of these corporations that tout how proud they are of their LGBT employees and how great their workplace policies are usually have workplace policies that are acceptable to positive for their staff in the corporate offices, but not frontline employees in places like businesses, warehouses, shipping and transfer and other lower wage jobs in that corporate pipeline. So it's not only that they're using us for pinkwashing, pretending that their support of LGBT people means that they're beyond criticism for their human rights abuses and other problems that these companies cause, but they're also pretending that their lower wage workers don't exist and claiming that only rich people could possibly be LGBT, which is obviously not the case and makes it all the more powerful that it was several of our low income community members who are leading the No Justice, No Pride disruptions.
Well, and let me also ask you this question. This is sort of slightly transferring here to the New York demonstration. But I think, Tracy, I also want your thoughts on this because I think this has been a big question in a lot of the movement for Black Lives disruptions. And, you know, one of the things I saw, Jill, and the criticism, well, there was two disruptions, if I'm not mistaken, in this parade in New York. And I've seen some of the criticisms raised kind of helter-skelter all over the place, but one of them being, well, oppressed groups shouldn't target oppressed groups, right? And that this is not the most effective way to reach these people, and that, like, you know, they were just out there celebrating whatever they were celebrating, and that many of them may have been sympathetic, but now you've driven a wedge. So basically sort of the big tent argument that better to get everybody under one tent than for the, as some have said, the quote-unquote left to attack the left, although I don't really like that framing. So I'm curious what you think about that, because I think that was, I thought that was an interesting response of all the ones that I had seen of why it shouldn't have been done, or the only one that I was willing to say had some currency.
Sure. Well, let's get specific for a second about what this Celebrate Israel parade was. Every June in New York City, down Fifth Avenue, there's a massive Celebrate Israel parade that is almost entirely aggressively right-wing and a particular kind of Zionism that supports the occupation and, in fact, erases the occupation and the existence of Palestinians. And this is one of many entities that support the occupation that uses LGBT people as a front, just like we were talking about pinkwashing with Capital Pride. Israel, and especially Israel's right-wing pro-occupation folks, really throw out there that Israel is the most supportive pro-LGBT country in the Middle East, which may or may not actually be true. But their talking point isn't about queer and trans people. It's about covering from criticism over the occupation. So the Celebrate Israel parade is a long parade of many different contingents that happens every year in New York. And for the past several years, there has been an LGBT contingent. Though, interestingly, that was a fight in 2012 to get an LGBT contingent in there. That was a point of a great deal of controversy. And often the folks who are engaging in militarism, like the occupation, are also anti-LGBT. Thanks, friends. So If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace were in coordination but ran a series of separate events to disrupt the Celebrate Israel parade this year, 2 weekends ago in New York. I was part of the If Not Now disruption. We disrupted the Hillel contingent because If Not Now is a movement of young American Jews, and Hillel at universities and colleges all over the United States really has a policy of enforcing only a particular set of views on Israel-Palestine that almost completely erases the existence of the Palestinians, let alone the occupation that denies them political and economic rights. JVP engaged in a series of disruptions, including one that was led entirely by JVP members who were queer and trans themselves, to disrupt the queer and trans contingent of the Celebrate Israel parade. And an organization called Jewish Queer Youth, which does terrific work in the Jewish Orthodox community in New York City to support LGBT youth in Orthodox families, many of whom get extreme rejection from their families and communities, was very critical of this particular segment of all of the disruptions that happened at this pro-occupation parade. Again, using pinkwashing, claiming that we were doing homophobia to other queer Jews, erasing the existence of anti-occupation queer and trans Jews, erasing our leadership, and using the bodies of queer and trans vulnerable youth, many of whom risk getting kicked out of their homes by anti-LGBT parents, to support the occupation, which is ridiculous. So I, and If Not Now, stand in support of the actions of the queer and trans leaders who disrupted that part of the parade.
Out of the hue and cry over a lot of that, it's sort of one of those, this is really not about what people say it's about type of thing. And I'm curious your thoughts about the similar issue, Tracy, because certainly I think the movement for Black Lives at that time, the Black Lives Matter movement, kind of made its name by not being afraid to disrupt people, kind of whoever, wherever, if they were doing the wrong thing. And it was, I think, a way of interjecting a lot of things in the conversation that never would have gotten there before. So, you know, generally in 2014, it was all highly celebrated. But, you know, as time went on, people have said, and I think people have said to, you know, things you and I have done here, that it's, you know, Black people dividing Black people, and that people shouldn't be targeting other people. Or I guess let me put it to you maybe in a different way. So I was out of town this weekend, but a text I got from somebody who was towards the back of the march was, you know, I've been waiting here all day. I just wanted to march. And there's a contingent behind me of all, I guess, Black and Latino trans people, and we're all in the sun, and it's taking too long, so how's that empowering to them, and it's just dividing our community? And, I mean, you know, that was their response, and this is what they were telling me. So I'm curious, from your perspective, and knowing you as a person, and knowing that you engage in actions to empower people and to make change, how are you viewing this issue of, I guess, the big tent versus sort of raising it sharply right in the space?
I tell people, we're not divided. We're trying to push you to a level of being uncomfortable so that you can see that the harm that's being done. Because lots of times people get, you know, like, oh, yeah, well, like, it's not as bad as it used to be. You know, so we should just lay low, you know, let the police march in a parade because the police are here to protect us, is what a lot of people is telling me, not knowing that police have been known for harassing, misgendering Black and brown trans women, and also sex trafficking little girls out of the as well. They need names. But, you know, so we're not here to divide. We're here to let you know that there's still a long way to go, even though we have came a long way. But sometimes we have to push a little bit, because no one, you know, I met last year, I participated in a pride parade. A year before that, and the year before that, I marched in the parade. I celebrated because that's all I knew. I realized that corporations were bad, and other Black people pushed me to, like, hey, why are you going to Capitol Pride? Stuff like that. So maybe this year, someone else like, yo, Capitol Pride Alliance is bad. I mean, as another Black, gay, queer, trans person also sees that, and I also want to join the movement also. So I don't think it divides. Some people might get upset in the moment, but once they take a moment to realize is why we're there, and if they actually hear why we're there, most of the time they understand. And we had quite a number of people join our protest. I went to all three lockdowns yesterday. I mean, during the Capitol Pride Parade, and we had quite a lot of people supporting us. People actually left the parade and joined us instead.
Well, you know, Mish, I left my little roundabout here that I was working on in the same place, but I'm curious what you think. I think this is an important issue, I think, in all social movements right now, where I think that, you know, in some ways, getting more momentum than ever before, but because of that, the differences in tactics, strategy, whatever it may be, are now becoming much more relevant than they had been before. So I'm curious your same thoughts on this sort of big tent issue.
I think that it's important to have these big disruptive actions in order to draw attention to the issues. If most people are willing to listen, like Tracy said, if they're put in a place where they're like, they're faced with the issue, or there's something going on, there's a blockade, they question it, they ask. It's a good way of educating people, like in this particular, in Capitol Pride Parade, a lot of people who are, were unaware of the issues of Capitol Pride. They show up, they're at Capitol Pride, they see this blockade, and after hearing us out, they're like, oh, maybe I should join this movement. And I think really effective.
Well, and one thing I will say, I thought the Washington Post article, I rarely say positive things about them, actually gave a pretty good balance. I mean, so you knew what it was about, wherever you fell on the spectrum, which is, you know, one thing I'm curious about too, Jill, and I want to talk more about sort of the 50th anniversary in and of itself. But I mean, how did you feel about the coverage that came out of that event? Because the issue is so distorted. I was just dismayed how easy it was for people to distort what took place because of the preconceived notions that are brought to it. Do you find that these actions, regardless of that, still help force the issue? Or is it, you know, maybe just like everything else, you're just still sort of pushing the hill, the ball uphill?
I've chosen to put a lot of my time and volunteer energy into If Not Now because of its strategy to polarize and educate the American Jewish public. American Jewish establishment organizations love to prevent particularly youth, but all American Jews, from learning about and discussing Israel's occupation of the Palestinians and the Israel-Palestine conflict in any detail or with a lot of reasonableness. So that's a main role of If Not Now, to force the conversation within our community and to bring a wider range of knowledge and a wider range of views to the public. And disruptive actions are part of our strategy. They're not the only part. We also have a bunch of really meaningful religious and educational events. But I think, especially with the Celebrate Israel parade, so many people just bring their kids to that parade. It's an annual family and community event, especially for the Orthodox community in New York. And there are a lot of kids, especially queer kids, who might want to have a haircut like mine someday, but whose families are not going to be down with that, let alone having them identify with a word like non-binary. Seeing proud, joyful American Jews standing up for ourselves as we really are, including in our Jewishness and in our queer and transness, and believing in human rights for all, including Palestinians, is revolutionary for some folks, particularly in that part of the Jewish community. That disruptive action was an olive branch, a handout to young people who might not feel able to express their political views. I think that's really important, and I was proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, well, I certainly got in some trouble defending you guys on the internet, but was very happy to do it because I thought the action really raised things to a different level. We are going to take another break here. We're going to come back with more on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we continue to be joined here in studio by Tracy Redd from Black Lives Matter D.C. and Keep D.C. for Me, and Joe Rainey, founder and CEO of Practice Makes Progress, and a member leader of If Not Now. And we are also joined for this segment in studio, very specially, by Lillianne Daigle, who's a network campaigner at Global Zero. I think that you moved up a level since the last time we had you on the show. What can I say? This is a big-time show only for big-time people. So we have been talking, Lily, and I know you had the opportunity to hear at least some of what we were talking about, the issues of disruptions at the Pride Parade, various different things. So anyway, I want to try to advance the ball just a touch here. You are with Global Zero, which is an organization that campaigns around, I'm going to go for the elimination of nuclear weapons. Okay, that's good. I was hoping it was no less than that. I'm curious how, let me put it to you like this. This is the sort of bigger issue for me, is the mainstreaming of just negative things, police, military contractors, whatever it is, like in everything, like the Martin Luther King Jr. parade, most of them start with the military color guard now. Everyone has military contractors in any parade that looks like good PR for them, for sure. They're going to be in it. The police, same thing. It's all PR. Makes sense why they do it. But it seems like to some degree, the potential harm that this mainstreaming causes, like, you know what I'm saying? Like the benefits of it are not commensurate with the cost. Like, okay, Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or whatever, let's just say everything you say is true and you're 100% for LGBTQ rights like you say you are. But if you're still willing to, like, build a weapon that can destroy all of humanity, you know, to some degree, what does that count for, I guess? So I don't know. Your thoughts on this issue.
First off, I don't think that any corporation that manufactures weapons, especially for profit, cannot claim that they're for LGBTQ plus rights. I think that designing weapons that are going to be used by the state to oppress and kind of like uphold global hegemony are automatically against any sort of equality, whether it's for LGBTQ plus two-spirit folks or racial justice, et cetera, et cetera. So I just unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, don't buy any of it. And I think that as organizers and activists, we have to be very conscious of the roles that those corporations are kind of trickling in, whether it's pinkwashing, greenwashing, et cetera.
Well, Joe, let me ask you this, too, because I actually think that there's a factual issue I want to sort of clear up here, which I think is relevant, because we raised the issue of pinkwashing and Israel and the role it plays, and I would say it's quite significant. I've had to battle that argument several times. But I guess the real question is how true is it in terms of Israel's actual practice as it concerns queer folks in terms of, I mean, they're saying they're a huge paradise. I'm curious if that even comports with reality.
Honestly, I don't think it matters all that much in the context of arguments where that is thrown out. I'm an American Jew. I don't have family in Israel. I went on Birthright Israel 11 years ago. I am not a foreign policy expert, and Israel is a foreign country to me. What I know is the American Jewish community. I am very proud to be an American Jew. I love this country, and I don't want to go anywhere else. So I don't think whether Israel is better or worse than other countries about LGBT rights is the relevant thing. Whether any one country is respecting all of its people, including its queer people, including its trans people, including its racial minority people, is relevant to political discussions within that country. That Israel isn't actively murdering queer youth isn't a bragging right. And that's really embarrassing when folks are claiming it as a bragging right, because Israel is starving and sometimes murdering Palestinian children, including queer and trans Palestinian children. So this argument that Israel is nice enough to queer people is not relevant.
Well, it reminds me of that old Chris Rock bit about people wanting credit for things they're supposed to do. Very relevant. Tracy, let me ask you this, because I think one thing I hear a lot, I know you must hear this a lot, around police violence is the issue of diversity in policing, right? I mean, and it comes on a couple levels. For example, the Feminist Majority Foundation has argued for years and years and years that there would be much less police violence if almost most of the cops were women and if most of the police departments are headed by women. Then there's the issue of police officers living in the communities they police. Then there's the issue of, you know, having more black police officers. So, I mean, I'm curious from your perspective, and you've had the opportunity to really travel and see how things are in a lot of different cities with policing in this country. I mean, is that a solution to the problem of police violence and police murder?
No, and I continue to tell people I'm not a reformist. You can't reform a system that is rooted in anti-blackness and racism. I think you should abolish it, first and foremost. The police officers at our blockade during Capitol Pride Parade, they placed all black officers in front of us. And I know they did it on purpose. So just because you look like me, you know, and we told officers, like, when we were chanting, you know, like, I love being black and I love you like you are me, we told officers that as well, because when they take off that uniform, they're just as black as we are, and we know that cops and PG County and other cities around the country have been harassed by police officers while they were off duty. You know, so how can we, you know, so to me, it doesn't matter what you look like, you know, just a face at this point, you know, so I don't believe that if it was headed by all women or more women, or if you lived in a community or not, to me, the police just need to be abolished. And that's a different show for a different time. but like DC has the gay lesbian unit liaison and the Metropolitan Police, where they have a trans woman as a sergeant, and they have gay and lesbian openly officers on that unit, and that doesn't make it any better for me. If I'm going to jail, I'm, you know, I still have to deal with the same system of oppression. Either way, whether it's a straight person or a gay person or a black or white person arresting me, I can still be killed, I can still be brutalized, I can still be attacked.
Well, I think those are relevant points. Lily, I don't know if you want to comment on the Feminist Majority Foundation, but I do think that, I mean, there is sort of a broader issue, I think, for social movements right now on a lot of different levels in a lot of different places, and that is sort of the structural versus the personal, right? I mean, obviously, Donald Trump is the president. I would say anyone who listens to this show knows I'm not a fan, and that's probably the most mild way I could say it. But nevertheless, you know, many of the things that I think all of us feel passionately about, there's people with R's and D's and other things behind their name that are just as bad or worse than he is. And I think a lot of people have been wondering here, especially now that we're halfway through the first year, if maybe a lot of social movements are shooting themselves in the foot a little bit more by focusing so heavily Trump, 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 and not issue, 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 that you start to lose the forest for the trees. I'm curious your thoughts on resistance, I guess.
Totally. I'll use nuclear weapons as an example. The issue of nuclear weapons exists whether Trump is president or not. Period. Donald Trump is terrifying with 17,000 nuclear weapons at his fingertips. It's more terrifying than average that man has unrestricted authority to launch a nuclear weapon whenever he wants and no one can stop him. But, you know, these weapons are not going to go away if he gets impeached. The system is going to continue perpetuating itself so that these weapons contractors, these military officials can continue making a lot of money off of essentially a bet that they can destroy the world if they need to. So I think we need to, as a movement, acknowledge a lot of folks have been woken up by the real fears that they have around Donald Trump, and we need to then kind of transition that conversation to one around systemic injustice and systemic oppression. Because The fact is the vast majority of the problems we're fighting are not going to go away when Donald Trump gets impeached or gets voted out of office.
Well, and depending on the issue, Mike Pence, the president, could get worse. On a lot of issues. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I think that's another question as well, Jill, is sometimes, you know, there is a be wary what you wish for kind of feel with a lot of this, too, because when you're sort of focusing personally as opposed to systemically, which I think a lot of times is relevant. I mean, there's many times where the easiest way to promote an issue is to just like put a stake in the ground on that issue and like use the thing that people are most attached to. So I'm not criticizing people for like using Trump as a lightning rod. But that in some ways that can also be slight erasure. I mean, you know, look, Trump is certainly not good on any LGBTQ issues, but Pence has probably one of the worst records that you could have as a politician in America. And to say like, well, you know, Trump would be, you know, he's less likely to just launch a nuclear weapon randomly, which is certainly relevant. But if it's like, we're going to put in the guy who wants pogroms against gays in America, and then it's just, whoa, what are we doing here? I mean, without a holistic frame, we could be up the creek without a paddle, as they say.
Oh, yes. I am personally very, very worried that if Trump gets impeached, the folks who have been woken up, who think we're living in a dystopia right now, but don't realize in their gut that lots of us have been living in a dystopia this entire time and for centuries since the United States was first colonized. I think a lot of those folks will be all, oh, cool, we got the weirdo out of office, we're done now, when Mike Pence is gearing up to very aggressively come for trans people. I am probably one of the more privileged trans people in this country, and I'm still personally scared. Mm-hmm. And I'm personally scared for a lot of my friends, especially those who don't pass, and especially those who are Black and those who are Muslim. So we've got a lot of work to do to welcome in and meet where they're at, all these folks who are realizing for the first time that shit up, if I'm allowed to say that. Because it is profoundly so. To welcome those folks in, meet them where they're at. A lot of folks come into progressive movements and get very worried about language and certain cultural tics that a lot of us have in progressive organizing spaces. I'm less worried about language and a lot more worried about, okay, folks are ready to do the right thing. That means seeing me as I am. That means accepting that I'm not a woman like you're assuming I am. And just be chill about that. And just be chill about the fact that the person sitting next to you is Black and you've been trained to think that they're automatically a threat, and like challenging yourself to unlearn the idea that Black people are automatically a threat. Lots of little things that are super easy for a person who's new to progressive activism to do. I say that a little bit sarcastically, but like, I don't care if it's hard. You got to do it anyway, or Trump or someone like him is going to come back again. We got to this point. We elected Donald Trump because of white supremacy. And when we get rid of Donald Trump, that does not end white supremacy. We've got a lot more work to do.
Yeah. You know, one story I always tell along those lines was the cop that shot the psychiatrist. I think it was like towards the end of last year, and he was trying to get his patient out of the street, who I believe had autism. And I remember the guy told the story about meeting the cop coming to apologize to him. And he was like, why did you shoot me? And the guy just goes, I don't know. And the psychiatrist was like, I believe that he actually didn't know, because that's how deep it is that his first thought was just like, shoot, even though his hands were up. And then it turns out that was one of the same police departments that had gotten docked for using the photos of Black people, like actual photos, not the little cutouts, for the target practice. And then you wonder why things like this are happening. And I think it's a very relevant, very, very relevant issue in how deep a lot of this stuff runs. And I think, you know, Tracy, on that note, you know, one of the things for me that I think is also very frustrating, and I think Jill touched on this quite well, the sort of, for a lot of people, it already isn't good. You know, I mean, everyone's, oh, this is democracy and we did this and we did that. And it's like, but if you're Black in America, it's very difficult to even release. I was just saying, I had a conversation with an older woman the other day. It was making a joke to me, but she was lived in the South in Jim Crow. And in the context of her joke was joking about how someone had said to her, oh, don't talk like that, you'll get lynched or whatever. And for her, it was just like normalized. That's her life. This is her little joke about her cousin. And I was like, man, like, this is unbelievable that we just had a little conversation about lynching in 2017. And people are just sort of like, well, just forget it. Or America's changed, or this, that, and the third. That really, you know, when you're like, oh, James Comey is so great, but this is the guy who promoted the Ferguson effect, that we just forget that that America really isn't a democracy, I guess. I find that that often is a problem with the sort of current moment as well.
Yeah, I tell people we never lived in democracy, first and foremost, and we have to realize that it's been bad for so many people for so long. And when I do my trainings, you know, and I train lots and lots of white people who are all of a sudden woken up and they went to the Women's March and they wanted to do something more and they were longing for something more, I'm like, you have to get to the point where I ask them this question: what are you willing to sacrifice for someone that doesn't look like you? You know, what are you willing to fight for if you're not going to personally benefit from it? And that's where I think the movement, lots of movements need to switch to and realize that we intersectionality, you know, like even over the past year, I've learned more about like environmental justice and how that affects black and brown communities. Because growing up, I was told, you know, black people don't recycle and black people don't care about the environment. But actually we do because we're impacted the most, you know. So it's, you know, and I also tell people when black people get free in this country, then everyone else can get free. And I get, well, what about like undocumented immigrants? I'm like, black immigrants exist. you know, realizing that black people in this country, you know, this country is built on our backs and with our blood and our sweat and our tears. And so when we get free, you know, then everyone else can start living a little bit more comfortably. And it's not any time before that. And we have to realize that, yeah, welcome to the movement, as I say, but, you know, you're a little bit behind. So how can we catch you up and get you out there to fight these oppressive systems? And lots of that, I tell people, is having conversations with your family. Mm. You know, realize that other people have it so bad. And you sitting at your cousin's or auntie's house for Thanksgiving and they vote for Trump. And you have, quote unquote, black friends that you, quote unquote, care about. And you're still sitting there comfortably. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it raises a very interesting point there. I'm actually glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of the maybe red thread running through a lot of this conversation we've had through the whole show is the importance of sort of system change over just policy change. I mean, I'm curious your thoughts on this, Lily, because even though I've sort of jokingly referenced the Feminist Majority Foundation thing, it actually is a very interesting study that they put together. And the context of it is that, and the numbers look right to me, is that the police departments headed by female police chiefs seem to have drastically lower, not drastically, but significantly lower rates of police brutality, which is relevant. But then I thought, when I thought about it for like a minute, is I said, but you know what? If you say you have 100 incidents of police brutality and you go to 50, did you really make that big of a difference? Like, for the 50 people who still got beat, I don't even know. And so that sometimes maybe do we sell ourselves a little bit short by pulling our horizons in?
Absolutely. I think that one case of police brutality is too many. So I find it to be a little bit ridiculous that people are kind of claiming that, you know, half is great. That's good. We're good. We as white women and we as humanity cannot settle for anything less than zero. We shouldn't be settling, and we need to continue fighting back and resisting, and we shouldn't sell our brothers and sisters short.
Mm-hmm. Jill.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of why those studies show the numbers that they do is because women are still an oppressed class in the United States as well. And if you're a woman and a cop and you advance to a higher level, it's because you're extraordinarily good at your job. Women aren't necessarily more nonviolent than people of any other gender or no gender. It's the gender system and gender oppression that causes a lot of women in different workforce places to be exceptionally good at their jobs. That's patriarchy making women do an extra mile to survive. That's not that women are necessarily better people. And white women still absolutely uphold white supremacy. This idea that feminist cops are going to save us is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's transphobic nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Exactly 1 minute left. Lily Ann Daigle, we brought you on from Global Zero. I didn't really ask you one question about nuclear weapons. Where can people learn more about what you're doing right now and what's like one top line thing you want them to do?
I think that the one top line thing I want people to do is to look into the Marquis Lew bill, which will limit Donald Trump and any president's authority to unilaterally start a nuclear war with no repercussions. And folks can check that out at globalzero.org.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We are going to leave it there for today's show. Thanks for everyone who's listening and everyone who watched on Facebook Lives. This was By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. See you next time.
by any means necessary.